With me now is Dr. Hans Bethe, who in 1967 won the Nobel Prize for determining the nuclear processes that generate the power of the sun and the stars. His research has led to breakthroughs in atomic theory, collision theory, the radiation of electrons, astrophysics, and quantum field theory. He made significant contributions to the development of the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb. During World War II, he was the director of the theoretical physics division of the Los Alamos Project for wartime development, where the atom bomb was developed. Now Bethe is an advocate of the freeze of nuclear weapons as a first step to arms control. Last week, the New York Times printed on the op-ed page a piece that he co-authored in support of nuclear freeze. Dr. Hans Bethe, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. And before we talk about why you're in favor of nuclear freeze now, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the development of the atom and the hydrogen bomb. When you first started to work on the Los Alamos project, did you as a physicist have any idea of the result of the project that you were embarking on?
Yes. I was very much aware of it, and so were many of my colleagues. We didn't talk much about it, because we were far too busy. But when I joined, and before I joined, I had some soul-searching whether we should do it. The main reason why I did it and why many others did it was that we knew that the Germans were hot on the trail, that they were working very hard on having an atom bomb, and it would have been a catastrophe if the Nazis had obtained the atom bomb and we did not.
Were there any discussions of the moral questions raised by the bomb, or was that sense of competition so great that you just wanted to get it done?
Not really. It is unlikely to have that during a war, but it is very proper to have it now, when we are at peace.
Did you know what to expect when the bomb first went off in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yes, we had figured out pretty accurately what would happen. Our main information came from a great British physicist, Sir Geoffrey Taylor, who had calculated with some accuracy just how wide the area of destruction would be, and that would tell us how many buildings would be destroyed and how many people. It still was terrible then to see the pictures.
Let's talk a little bit about your support of a freeze now. You said that when the bomb was being developed, that wasn't the time for the moral questions because it was wartime, and you're all very concerned about the Germans possibly building and using the bomb. Did you ever think that the arms race would reach the current proportions?
I never thought so. It is absolutely absurd, the proportions it has now reached. We were thinking at the end of the war, in terms of maybe 10, maybe a few tens, certainly not more than 100 nuclear weapons. The atom bomb for some time served probably a useful purpose. Namely, we had completely disarmed and Western Europe was prostrate. So there was a considerable danger that the Soviet Union would acquire more and more territory in Europe. The atom bomb prevented that. But a few of them would have been enough. And the situation which then obtained was very different from now. At that time we had a monopoly, now we don't. Certainly, we never thought, nobody of us thought, that there would be 1,000, many thousands, 10,000 on each side. It makes no sense. There are not that many targets in either country. Even if you wanted to destroy all the cities above 100,000 population in the Soviet Union, 200 or so weapons would be enough, and similarly for the United States. And then you have some military targets. Still, these numbers are beyond all belief, beyond all comprehension, and they are beyond any military value. This has been emphasized by Henry Kissinger when he was the Secretary of State. What do these numbers mean? What meaning does it have if we have 10,000 nuclear weapons and the Russians have 8,000? That doesn't give us any advantage. We'll all be dead.
We're told, I think, that the atom bomb, for instance, is a really outdated weapon, and that a lot of the weapons in our current arsenal are, in fact, really outdated because the Soviets have weapons that make them kind of obsolete. And that's why we have to develop not only more weapons, but more precise weapons. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I would turn it a little bit differently. Weapons have developed all the time. And what has developed in the last 20 years is not the weapons themselves, but the means of delivery. That is to say, 20 years ago, we mostly relied on bombing planes. At that time, just at that time, the ballistic missiles came in. The ballistic missiles first were built on land, the intercontinental ballistic missile, and then also a little later, they were put on submarines. So now we have three types of weapons. I was in the President's Science Advisory Committee back in the late 50s and stayed in a subcommittee of that, which dealt with strategic weapons, essentially throughout the 60s. We were very much aware at that time that at some time in the future, land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles might become obsolete. And that time is now rather close. So our government is terribly afraid that the Russians might one day send their very big intercontinental missiles over here and destroy our Minuteman, which is our intercontinental missile. Now, my answer to that is it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. We have a very small fraction of our nuclear forces on our intercontinental missiles. The main part, more than half of our weapons, are on submarines. Submarines you cannot find. Once they are at sea, they are undetectable. You cannot see them from the top. If you fly over the region where the submarine is, there's no sign. If you have a satellite, there's no sign. You cannot see them by radio waves, by radar. So essentially, submarines are undetectable, and that makes them essentially invulnerable. Now, already back in the late 50s, military planners and our President's Science Advisory Committee decided that someday the land-based missiles might become vulnerable. And for this reason, we very strongly favored the development of very powerful submarine-based missile force, and that we have.
What responsibility do you think physicists have in the development of new arms and in the buildup of the arms race? I mean, like, you helped in the development of weapons, which now you feel have gotten terribly out of control. You're opposed to the current arms buildup. On the other hand, you have no control over it, really, at this point. I'm sure you're not at this point, called in to consult on the policy.
I have no control over it, nor should I. This really should be decided by the elected representatives of the people, that is, by the executive and the Congress. All that physicists can do is to give information, to tell people what nuclear weapons mean, to tell people what sense it makes militarily to have this or that number, to tell people that submarine-based missiles are much safer than land-based missiles, and that therefore really our nuclear weapons, our strategic force, is far superior to the Russian strategic force. So we have really no reason to build up our forces. Let me go back in history for a while. After the war, the Second World War, I mean, most of us physicists who were at Los Alamos or at Chicago or Oak Ridge joined together to try and inform the politicians of the dangers of nuclear weapons. And we tried very hard to have an international control of these atomic weapons. We tried very hard to push the so-called Baruch Plan, which really was made by Acheson and Lilienthal and Oppenheimer, and which provided that all features of atomic activities should be under international control. Unfortunately, this plan came to nothing because the Russians were opposed. Unfortunately, even if the Russians had accepted it, probably it might not have been accepted by the United States. We were never put to the test in this matter. But we have constantly argued for that, and we started back in 1946 to do so. We, of course, argue from the standpoint of numbers, of the power of weapons. We understand very well what nuclear weapons do.
Do you think that either our policymakers in the government or we, the voters in the American public, are really well informed about the power of nuclear weapons?
That has changed from government to government. If we go back a while, John Kennedy was very well informed, and his Secretary of Defense, McNamara, was very well informed. Unfortunately, it is no longer so. And one of our troubles is precisely that the people in government nowadays are not well informed. And so they listen to the people who have the most outrageous ideas. That's our real trouble. If we had a government better informed, then some such people as Mr. Pipes, who is one of the extreme anti-Russian and arms build-up people, would not be listened to.
How can you tell they're not informed? What makes you say that?
Pardon me?
How can you tell that the people in government, the policymakers, aren't well informed? What do you think gives
that
away?
By what they say and by what they are planning. I have one interesting example. Secretary Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, gave a talk in one university, and it was listened to by two of my friends, one who is on my side and would like to stop the arms race, one who is on the other side and who wants to increase the arms race. They both said that Secretary Weinberger really didn't know his job. And if the Secretary of Defense doesn't know his job, how can the president?
If you had an audience with the president and were able to tell him why you supported a freeze, what would you tell him?
Well, I would tell him that we need to change the direction. We have been building up our armaments. We have been trying to stay ahead of the Russians. But we know very well, and that is just a historic fact, whatever we do, the Russians will do 5 years later. The government claims, for instance, that throughout the 1970s, the Russians engaged in an arms race and we do not. It is wrong. In the first half of the 70s, we engaged in the arms race. We built up the number of our weapons and more than doubled it. Then in the second half of the 70s, the Russians did exactly the same thing as we did. We had invented something which is called MIRV, the Multiple Independently Targeted Reentry Vehicles. We were ahead of them. We thought we had an advantage. So we developed all our bombs that way. And 5 years later, the Russians had it too and did exactly the same. So in every step that we take in the arms race, we can almost be sure that the Russians will imitate us. It will not give us any advantage. And therefore, there is just no salvation. There is no advantage in our constantly improving qualitatively and quantitatively our nuclear weapons. We want to stop that. We want to have a stop in the arms race. And the simplest way to do this is the so-called freeze.
If you're just joining us, Dr. Hans Bethe is my guest. And he's a physicist who helped design the atom and the hydrogen bomb. He was the head of the theoretical division of the Los Alamos Project during World War II. He won the Nobel Prize in 1967 for some of his physics discoveries. And he's now supporting nuclear freeze. I think one of the most difficult things to grasp when discussing nuclear power is that you can't undo a discovery. Like, even if we decided to dismantle all the current weapons, not necessarily me, but somebody would have the knowledge of how to build them up again, and they'd maybe start being built again as soon as they were dismantled. Does that trouble you that there is no way of really ending the destructive quality of nuclear weapons?
There is no way, and it disturbs me, but I cannot change the laws of nature. That's the way it is. Once they have been discovered, you cannot undo it. And so I do not believe that we shall ever come to the point where there are no nuclear weapons. And I don't even think that this would be a sensible thing to do. But instead of 10,000 on each side, I would like to have 100 or 200. And that would be a big difference. And it would at the same time give enough safety so that nobody in some obscure country can come along and suddenly build new nuclear weapons. I'm afraid they are with us. I think our emphasis on constant advances, on constant refinements, on increasing of numbers has been all wrong. We cannot undo nuclear weapons, but at least by our decision, by our political decision, we can limit them. And that's what I would like to see.
You, I'm sure, know a lot of the young physicists who are getting started in the field today. Do they face a lot of difficult decisions about the kind of research they're going to do? Because I have a feeling that more and more a lot of the research that's funded by physicists is government-related defense or war research.
No, I'm happy to say that is not so. We have one organization in the government, which is the National Science Foundation, which is entirely non-military. And the research they sponsor has nothing to do with any military problems and nothing with nuclear weapon problems at all. There are, of course, jobs at the national laboratories which make nuclear weapons, And this every young person has to decide for himself if he wants such a job. But there are sufficient jobs which are unrelated to any military applications.
A lot of our listeners are, I think, familiar with the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. Helen Caldicott is currently the president of that. And I think the basic premise of the group, as she describes it, is that doctors are concerned with the health and well-being of people, and fighting nuclear war is the most important preventive medicine that any doctor can be engaged in. Is there any comparable group of physicists, or do you think that there should be one?
First, on the second part of the question, there is the Federation of American Scientists, which was founded in November, I believe, of 1945, immediately after the end of the Second World War, and which has existed ever since then. It has about 5,000 members, I believe. It is very active. They investigate, for instance, at the present time, the proposal which was made by President Reagan on arms reduction. And I want to say one more thing about the freeze. The freeze is fine, but it doesn't really get us very far. What we need is arms reduction. And so I welcomed very much that Reagan proposed some scheme of arms reduction. Now, I don't believe that Reagan's proposal is the best that could be made, because it requires far too many sacrifices of the Russians, and the Russians are not going to agree to it. Now, my friend, the director of the Federation of American Scientists, has made a different proposal, which is based on the agreement we have already concluded, the SALT II agreement. Namely, he says, we all want to reduce weapons. Why don't we just take the SALT II agreement, which the Russians have fully subscribed to, and which in fact is to our favor, and now let's cut all the numbers in half. And that sounds very simple, and would be much more negotiable, I believe, than President Reagan's proposal. That idea of cutting the number of weapons in half, by the way, was originally made by George Kennan, the great diplomat who for many years was ambassador to Soviet Russia and who is probably the best expert on the inside and outside. Now, the second organization that exists is the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I don't agree with them on everything, but in this matter of arms control, I agree with them very well, and I have signed statements with them. The physicians have a somewhat different approach, and a very important approach, which is complementary to ours. We talk about the weapons, they talk about the effect on people. And in that respect, we should listen to the Physicians for Social Responsibility very carefully. They paint a picture which is simply horrible, and I find, unfortunately, I find nothing wrong with that picture. I'm afraid that's how it would be. So I very much welcome the efforts of the physicians.
There's been discussion of limited nuclear war and how it, in fact, would be, if not exactly winnable, survivable. What effects as a physicist do you think it would have on the environment if, say, two or four of the modern bombs that we have now were detonated in different parts of the world?
It would be very bad for the people who are the target, who are actually being hit by these bombs. It would be of very little consequence for the people at large, practically none.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would be quite different if you don't talk about three or four, but talk about 500. There has been an investigation by the National Academy of Science, which used not 500, but 5,000 nuclear weapons exploded by each side. And they concluded that it would, of course, be absolutely devastating for the two countries directly involved, and this would probably equally include Western Europe. But for the rest of the world, it would be damaging, but not fatal. In other words, what would the biggest effect would in fact be that the destruction of the ozone layer, which protects us from ultraviolet radiations from the sun, and that layer would be very largely destroyed, and therefore probably if there were such a major nuclear war, people generally would have to restrict their outdoor living to a minimum. They would have to stay inside, behind doors, behind glass, nearly all their life. But otherwise, well, it wouldn't be fatal, and especially the radioactivity outside the countries which are directly the targets would not be a really major trouble.
Dr. Hans Bethe is my guest, if you're just joining us. You were the director of the theoretical division of the Los Alamos Project and helped to develop the atom bomb. Then in the early 50s, you helped develop the hydrogen bomb. What questions did you ask yourself before working on the development of that, after having seen the destructive powers of the atom bomb, and also the war was over in the early 50s?
Yes. I worked on the hydrogen bomb, having struggled against it with hands and feet. I wrote a big article against the hydrogen bomb in 1950 in Scientific American. I argued everywhere against it. Then, however, Edward Teller invented a method of making a hydrogen bomb, which was totally different from anything that had gone before, and which made it clear that nearly any country could build it. That being so, I became afraid that the Russians might build one. Now, I wasn't clever enough to look at the way out. And instead, I worked not very intensively, but I somewhat looked at the development of the hydrogen bomb. What we should have done at that time is to say, all right, we are going to develop it. We are not going to test it. Everybody can see the test when it happens. A hydrogen bomb is so complicated that nobody is going to use one without having tested it. As long as the Russians don't test it, we don't test it. If we had concluded such an agreement, then maybe we would not have hydrogen bombs now. And it is this kind of agreement, this kind of, you cannot prevent development, but you can prevent testing. And this kind of agreement could very well slow down the arms race to very little.
Freeman Dyson, who knew you well and was working with you during that period, said that while you were off in the early 50s working on the hydrogen bomb, that he felt when he saw you that you had really lost your zest for physics. Do you feel that was or is true in any way, having seen like the destructive possibilities of the discoveries?
I had not lost my zest for physics, and I'm still doing physics. That's why I'm here. In 1 hour, I'm supposed to give a talk about physics, about astrophysics, to be sure. One thing I cannot do anymore is the very complicated types of physics, the frontier of physics. That is beyond me. Nobody can do this unless he does it full time. and probably nobody above 50 can do it anyway. But there are many parts of physics which are very interesting and which you can do spending half your time on it. And that's what I have done since then. I think Freeman Dyson made the wrong observation in this case.
Do you ever wish that the discovery that you collectively made in the 1940s that led to the atom bomb could be undiscovered?
Yes, I do. I do, but I don't see how it could be.
Although you're against nuclear weapons now and are an advocate of freeze and arms limitations, you do support nuclear power.
I do support nuclear power. I think nuclear power is now and will be more in the future an extremely important source of energy. Nuclear power can last far longer than coal, let alone oil. Many countries need it desperately. I think it will reduce the chance of war, because when countries have enough energy, enough power, then they don't need to attack their neighbors. And so I am for nuclear power and against nuclear weapons.
Can you tell us briefly if you have any hope for solar energy, since your Nobel Prize was for discovering some of the power generation of the sun?
Not within the next 50 years. I don't know. Maybe sometime in the future there it will contribute. For the moment, it is no major contribution.
I wish we had more time to talk about that, but I know that you have to leave now. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and I want to say once more, we must stop the arms race.
Dr. Hans Bethe has been my guest, and he was the head of the theoretical division of the Los Alamos Project during World War II, and participated in the development of the atom bomb and also of the hydrogen bomb. In 1967, he received a Nobel Prize for his physics research, and he now, as you've heard, supports a nuclear freeze as a first step to arms limitation.